Early in the service, Dave McKnight read for us from Romans chapter 11. I'd like to ask you to go back there. And as most of you know, we have been away from our study in Romans for several weeks because of the 75th anniversary. And now we are returning to it to focus our thoughts on this 11th chapter and, Lord willing, to finish this chapter and this major section of Romans by the Christmas holidays. We'll actually be taking a break from it next week for Thanksgiving, but I do intend here with the Lord's help to finish this out by the middle of November. And then very naturally, it'll be a good time at the beginning of the new year to start into the very practical and encouraging teaching about the Christian life that starts in Romans chapter 12. This morning, we're going to be looking at Romans 11, verses 11 to 16. That'll be our text, Romans 11, 11 to 16. Might do well to just remind ourselves of where we have been in our study of actually Romans 9 through 11. I have reviewed this section a number of times, but it's probably not a bad thing because it's pretty complicated material, and it's easy to lose our train of thought in all of the teaching that is here. But the last time I was reviewing that with you, I gave you a kind of a simplified way how this all hangs together. Of course, the Apostle Paul, in defending the gospel ultimately, is defending the faithfulness of God to all of his promises, particularly the promises that he made to the nation of Israel. And at the beginning of chapter 9, in verses 1 to 5, Paul is overcome with emotion as he expresses his burden for the Israelites, the vast majority of which were rejecting this gospel that he was preaching. And he expresses his concern for them, but also brings up the question of how all of those people could be lost and how his heart could be broken about it. And yet at the same time, God be faithful to the many, many things that he promised to the nation Israel. And so the rest of this is really a vindication of God and his faithfulness and his promises. It is set here to encourage us to keep trusting God and to trust in this gospel message about the righteousness of God through Christ. Despite the fact that there are many mysteries in the plan of God, despite the fact that we don't always see God's work happening immediately the way that we might expect, these chapters are here to encourage us to trust the Lord and his gospel. And when he's dealing with that, Paul breaks this down in roughly a past, present, future structure. In chapter 9, verses 6 to 29, he is focusing there on Israel's past. And when I say past, I mean really, really past, as in eternity past, as in what went on in the councils of God regarding the nation Israel, God's sovereign decrees from all eternity. Israel's past, its eternal past, the decree of God that he made to save certain specific descendants of Abraham and to pass over others who ended up in time rejected of him. That's the theological background to what is happening on earth with Israel. It's all about what God determined ahead of time in the past. But when it comes to Israel's present, there's another part to the answer. And these two things both go together, even though in our minds they're hard to integrate and both of them stand side by side and aren't really resolved. In the present, chapter 9, verse 30, all the way through chapter 11, verse 10, is targeting the unbelief of the nation Israel. And the fact that they had not submitted to this gospel about the righteousness of God through Christ. The explanation for their lost condition in that passage, in this section, is that they are not believing, that they have rejected the Messiah that God had promised and had sent for their salvation. So past and present, and starting in our text today, Romans 11:11, now we're looking toward the future primarily. Now the Apostle Paul is unveiling for us something of the plan of God and how all of his work will come together in the end time to save not only a mass of Gentile peoples like ourselves, but actually to draw to himself also a mass of Jewish people in the end times. So starting in verse 11, this is what we would call eschatological, that it is looking at the end times and God's program for the final redemption of the nation Israel, that is those who are living at that time. And all of that brings us to the doxology at the very end of chapter 11, verses 33 to 36, which is the only right response that our hearts can make, the only fitting response, given all that's been taught about the grace and the sovereignty and the wisdom of God. It is a response of worship. It is a response of saying, whether or not I understand how all these strands come together and whether or not I have questions still, I am just falling down before God. He has given me just a little slice of his wisdom, and I am compelled to praise and worship him. And indeed, all of these things in the end are designed to bring him glory. And I'm encouraged by that. That is the note that we want to end on eventually as we conclude this chapter. There probably are going to be things that we still don't understand. There are things that I don't understand, even as I preach from this passage. But I think that there is enough understanding for us all to end up at this point. To move from being troubled by whatever theological questions to a spirit of humble adoration before an all-wise God. That is the ultimate goal. And in a few weeks, Lord willing, we'll be focusing on that doxology. What we're going to say now, Lord willing, is going to feed into that and motivate it. Now, really, we would struggle to have that spirit of adoration, especially if we did not have these verses that we're going to start looking at. Because the last section that we considered, the last time we were in this passage, it frankly was a very difficult set of verses. And it was difficult to grasp, and it was difficult for me to preach. We were looking at verses 7 to 10 of Romans 11, where the focus is largely on the spiritual hardness of the nation Israel. And the focus was on God in response to their hardness. Actually, he hardens them even more, and he rejects them. In fact, look at the quotations from the Old Testament that end that section. Look at Romans 11:9. Speaking of the nation Israel, of many people within that nation, let their table become a snare and a trap, a stumbling block and a retribution for them. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see, and bend their backs forever. That's actually a prayer. It's an imprecatory prayer. It's where David ended up as he thought about his enemies, and really the only recourse that God had with those people if they did not turn was to judge them, or God wouldn't be fair. And now Paul is picking up those words to basically pray that way for Israelites who were rejecting the Lord. As if to say, God, if these people don't turn to you, the only right thing for you to do is to judge them. They have had all this opportunity. They have turned their backs on you. They are out there in the dark now. And really, if that's not going to change, then let them be in that condition forever. Bend their backs forever. That would be the only right thing for you to do. And even though we have a hard time accepting that, we recognize, I trust, that justice requires it at some point. And yet it's a pretty depressing note to end on. It would have been pretty hard to move from there to of him and through him and to him are all things, to God be the glory. That would be pretty rough transition. Paul does not leave it there. He does not want judgment to have the last word. That's why he gives us, under the supernatural direction of the Holy Spirit, the passage that we're beginning to look at today. And actually, even those passages, even those verses there, 7 to 10, have just a little glimmer of hope, right? Because at the beginning in verse 7, It says, what then? Israel failed to obtain what it was seeking. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened. He goes on to talk mostly about the rest that were hardened, but he does have this little glimmer of hope that there are people of God. There is a remnant out there. They may be small, but God has his people. The elect actually did obtain salvation. Well, that little glimmer of hope assured us that the rejection of Israel is not total, that it was not 100% of the Jewish people that were rejected of God. It was not total. There was a remnant. There was a group that God had chosen from all eternity and that presently were recognizing that Jesus of Nazareth is the long-awaited Messiah, and they had cast themselves on him for righteousness. In fact, I shared with you in that message and in this whole section in chapter 11 so far, some stories, a couple of stories of dramatic conversions of people who were Jewish, who nevertheless came to faith in Christ. They were part of the remnant, and people like that exist today. Well, what was in that section a little glimmer of hope, as the Apostle Paul begins to look toward the future and toward the consummation of God's program for both Jews and Gentiles, that little glimmer of hope becomes a flood of light and joy and anticipation. And it is that promise of the conversion of the mass of Jewish people in the end times that finally leads him to the of him and through him and to him are all things. And it really is the keynote of the joy and the worship in that passage. The glimmer of hope becomes a flood of light. Read with me Romans 11, verse 11. Once again, Paul begins a section by asking a question. Question that no doubt he's anticipating people ask in response to what he's already said. So I ask, did they stumble? Did the Jewish people stumble in order that they might fall? That is, in order that they might fall permanently and not recover in general, the nation of Israel not enjoy the redemption of God? Did they stumble in order that they might fall? By no means. He emphatically denies that conclusion, just as he's done other times when people have taken a point of his theology and have gone too far with it, have abused it. He comes back and says, do not come to the position that God is forever through with the mass of Jewish people. By no means should you think that. Israel's rejection is not only not total, Israel's rejection is not final either. It is not permanent. What we're seeing today, where most Jewish people reject Jesus Christ and only a few Jewish people receive him, that is a temporary situation. That is not the permanent plan that God has for these people. And that is our point this morning. Israel's rejection is temporary. There is more to come. We have a sequel awaiting. It has not yet been released, but it is a glorious scene that the world has to anticipate as God steps in to do what he predicts in this passage. Israel's rejection is temporary. And what we find in this text are two arguments explaining and defending that assertion that Israel's rejection is temporary. What I'd like to do is focus on the arguments and then at the end of the message suggest some applications for us. The first argument that takes up most of this passage is God's plan for Israel's salvation, verses 11 to 15. That is one reason we know that Israel's rejection is only temporary, and that is that God has a plan to redeem them in the end. These verses, 11 to 15, they introduce what is going to be revealed in much more detail at the end of the chapter. And what they tell us is that God has orchestrated and is orchestrating the events of the present age to contribute to a plan that he has so that in the end times, the bulk of Jewish people actually do believe. Paul is going to sketch that out in two cycles here, two cycles that overlap a good bit. I'd like to walk through these. First of all, at the middle of verse 11 to verse 12, we have the first cycle. He says, as his immediate response to the question, verse 11, rather through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. Kind of a weird way of answering the question to say that God is working through the Gentiles to make people jealous. Normally we think of jealousy as being something bad, but there are cases in certain relationships and in certain circumstances where jealousy is something good. It would be wrong to be jealous if you strongly desire something that somebody else has that really you have no connection with and have no claim to. That would be a wrong kind of jealousy. But if you are jealous for something that in some way belongs to you, that's a good kind of jealousy. And there is a biblical sense in which salvation belongs, the Messiah belongs to the Jews. God is wanting to prompt them with that sort of feeling of the outrage of, why are these people getting it and we're not? This doesn't add up. What's going on with that? That's the sort of spirit that actually the Lord wants to generate in their hearts. It's not the first time Paul had mentioned this. Actually, back in chapter 10 and verse 19, he had said, quoting Moses, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation, I will make you angry. That's Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 21. And you may remember that Deuteronomy 32 is a song of Moses, actually mostly about God's judgment on these people. And when he says, I'm going to make you jealous by another nation, he's speaking actually of periods of defeat that God had in store for them in consequence of their disobedience. Times when the Lord actually favored the enemies of Israel more than he favored Israel. And he puts them in this situation of being surrounded by wicked pagan people who are actually being successful, who actually defeated them, or who actually take them off into exile. God's blessing is on the Gentiles, and they're sitting there empty-handed. And they are suffering destruction at the hands of these other people, these bad people that God had actually blessed. It strikes me that this idea of jealousy is kind of what was troubling the prophet Habakkuk. You remember when God reveals to him that the Babylonians are going to come and deal with Israel and God's going to deal with their unrighteousness. But Habakkuk says, how can that work? How are you going to use these more wicked people, the Babylonians, to punish your people, the Jewish people? Well, the attitude, the pushback that Habakkuk had toward the Lord is precisely what God is working to create in the hearts of all Jewish people. This isn't right. This doesn't make sense. Okay, right, that's true. This is not really the way things ought to be. Why? What do you suppose is the explanation? How should you respond? You should be seeking the same blessing in the Messiah that the Gentile people are experiencing. So this principle of God working through Gentile peoples in their lives that before had been about judgment on them, the same pattern is now focusing on the matter of salvation. And God is saying, my redemptive blessing on the Gentiles is designed to arouse you and get you to ask questions and get you to seek me and my salvation. And Paul goes further in verse 12 with a lesser to greater argument when he says, now if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? Now, Paul is not going to minimize at all the badness of Israel's condition at this point. He is not minimizing how sad it is that at the present time, most of those people reject the Lord and are under God's condemnation. But he is working to look past that, and he's focusing on actually all of the redemptive good that in the end is going to come out of the present bad. And so often, as happened in the book of Acts, when the Jewish people rejected the gospel, as Paul shows up in this town or that town, I've shown you, I think, some examples of that, a few accept, many reject. He leaves the synagogue, or he's kicked out of the synagogue, and he finds somebody else who will hear him. And as one door is shut with the Jews, another one swings wide open for the Gentiles, and their trespass, their failure, ends up being a blessing because it leads so many Gentiles to the opportunity to know Christ. And it wasn't just the book of Acts. This has been going on for 2,000 years now. That there has actually been a good result from all of those Gentile people rejecting Jesus. The good result is the gospel has gone out more broadly to Gentile peoples. In fact, there's a sense in which you and I are here because the Jewish people rejected their Messiah. That's really behind the point that Paul is making. It's a strange way to look at it, but that is the case. Part of the good that came out of that evil was that the gospel came to us eventually. You and I are here because they rejected the Messiah. Now, Paul's not going to stop there. He's just making that point along the way to say, look, if that is the case, that God turned that evil for good, consider the prospects of what God will do when he has brought in the full number of Gentiles that he intends to save in this age. If God turned the rejection of Israel into blessing for outsiders, can you imagine how vast, how glorious will be the blessing when he then returns to work again among the so-called insiders, the people of the covenant, the people of Israel? Lesser to greater, if God has brought so much good out of the present problem, think about how much more good he's going to bring about through the blessing that he has given us. Now, we find that very exciting. We find that very exciting because it is so personal and it is so much a part of how we got saved. But I want to stress something that I've commented on before, that to a Jewish person reading this, that was so counterintuitive that it would have been disturbing, that it would have been shocking to them. According to the prophecies of the Old Testament, what was going to happen was, first, Israel is restored, and then the Gentiles are joined to the Lord. Let me give you just one example. I'm reading here from Isaiah chapter 2. At the beginning of that chapter, it says, "It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, shall be lifted up above the hills. All the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." You get the picture. God dramatically works to restore the nation Israel. Even their capital city is reestablished. There is some kind of even worship place that is reestablished. And the nations are drawn to it. So first Israel is restored and then the Gentiles. Now, I don't think Paul is denying that that is going to happen. That is what the promise says will take place. But he is filling us in on something that was not clear in the Old Testament. And that is that before any of that really happens, there's this whole other period that we have come to call the church age, where God is actually doing the opposite of what will happen in Isaiah chapter 2. That first of all, he is targeting, once the people generally reject him, he turns his focus primarily on the Gentiles. And then he's going to use the Gentiles to be the attractive influence for the Jews. And then when the Jews are back, then he's going to attract more Gentiles. You understand, there's a sequence here. But he is filling you in on a part of it, this church age, that really was not revealed clearly in the Old Testament. Saving a mass of Gentiles first, and then using them to draw the Jewish people to Christ. You can imagine how hard it would be for a Jewish person to accept that. In fact, I was thinking about this related to the Exodus story. If you could kind of do a rerun of the Exodus following the pattern here, you have these Jewish people the night of the death of the firstborn. And you remember God had told them to put the blood on their doorpost, and that would be the sign for the angel to pass over. Well, it's almost as though the Jewish people don't want to do that. They don't believe that anymore. They think it's just something from their heritage, and their attitude is, we're okay. Look, we're Jewish people. We've been through this before. We're descendants of Abraham. God protected our forefathers. We don't really care. It's just kind of a national, physical, sort of superficial attachment to the Lord, not really believing what he had said, not really believing that they had to apply the blood to their case. But you've got a bunch of Egyptians out there who've heard the story and who believe that God delivered through the shedding and the application of the blood. And while all the Jewish people are relaxing and just assuming everything's okay and not really paying attention, you've got all these Egyptian people scrambling around to kill a lamb and to go through this ritual and to get the blood and to put it on their doorpost. And in the middle of the night, the angel comes, and the ones who are spared are the Egyptians. And the Jewish people, their firstborn, are slain. That is what's happening in the present age. But you understand how disturbing that would be if you're a Jewish person, and that is the explanation here. Nevertheless, that is what is taking place. And Paul wants to reiterate that. He knows, I'm sure, that this is troubling to Jewish people. This would not add up to them. And so he repeats what he's already said as he goes into verses 13 and 14. But he is specifically addressing the Gentile believers there in the church at Rome. Look at verse 13. Now I am speaking to you Gentiles, right? So he's going to turn it more directly to the Gentiles. Inasmuch then as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry in order somehow to make my fellow Jews jealous and thus save some of them. We'll stop there for now. He speaks in these verses about his ministry as an apostle primarily to Gentile people. And he says, I magnify the ministry that God has given me. Literally, I glorify it. It's the same terminology that's used so often in the New Testament for glorifying God. What does he mean by saying, I glorify my ministry? Certainly is not drawing to attention to his role in a proud way as if to get glory for himself. This is a way of saying, I am making a huge deal of the ministry that God has entrusted to me. I am not having small thoughts about it. I am not minimizing it as though it is worth very little. In my mind, this is enormous. I am wanting to present it and to carry it out in a way that is in keeping with the greatness of this ministry. I'm making a big deal about it. But it's interesting how he fills out the statement. Because in his mind, the biggest deal is not that God has shown mercy to these pagan peoples that had no previous connection to him. I mean, that was a big deal. That was unexpected. That was dramatic. But in Paul's mind, notice how he says, I magnify my ministry, verse 14, in order somehow to make my fellow Jews jealous and thus save some of them. In Paul's mind, the biggest deal and the greatest result of all of this is that God will use the mercy shown to the Gentiles in order to work so that he can show even greater mercy to his own people that were at that time hardened against him. Now, I don't doubt that Paul loved the Gentiles and that he was thrilled when any Gentile came to Christ. But it's only natural that he would love his people first and most. He's already talked about that at some length in this section of Romans. And yes, he was excited about reaching the Gentiles, but what he's telling us here is that he was most excited about reaching the Jews through the Gentiles. Not just because Gentile people were coming to Christ, but because it was going to be through this process that eventually God was going to make his own people jealous so that he could end up saving a whole bunch of them. And that's really where Paul's, that the greatest part of his passion was not the Gentiles, but it was reaching the Jews through the Gentiles. Now, we're going to see in our next message that truth that I just summarized there. It really has a way of putting us Gentiles in our place. It really has a way of humbling us, and Paul's going to humble us before this is over. But for now, we're not in that section yet. I would like us to try to catch the enthusiasm of the Apostle Paul for the salvation of the Jewish people. And what he says now in verse 15, for if their rejection means the reconciliation of the world, In other words, God had rejected them at a certain point. The result was the reconciliation of the world is in all the non-Jewish people that came to Christ. What will their acceptance when the Lord now resumes his working and draws them back? What will that mean but life from the dead? That's the future that Paul anticipates as the outcome of all of this is life from the dead. Now that expression, life from the dead, can be interpreted in two ways. It could be speaking of a spiritual resurrection. Very occasionally, you find the Bible speaking of resurrection in terms of the deadness of the human heart being eliminated and coming to life spiritually. And it may be that that's talking about the many, many more Gentile people that are going to be like the third installment, I guess we could say, of all of this, and just this growing number of believers. Specifically, Revelation chapter 7 teaches that during the tribulation period, the Lord is going to raise up 144,000 believers that are identified as members of specific tribes of Israel. And as you read on, you find in verses 9 to 10 a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." That wonderful scene of worship in heaven. And in the sequence of that chapter, it may well be that that massive crowd of people from all over the world is actually evangelized and brought to Christ by these 144,000 Jewish servants of God in the world. If Romans 11 is pointing to this idea of spiritual resurrection, it may be that it is pointing that far ahead to not just the conversion of Jewish people, hundreds of thousands of them ultimately, but also to even more Gentiles that are brought to Christ. And there's just this wave of grace upon wave of grace that the Apostle Paul is looking forward to. That could be what he is anticipating. In my mind, it's more likely that he is speaking here actually of physical resurrection, physical life from the dead. That is the normal way that that expression is used in the New Testament. And it's most in keeping with the, we would say, post-tribulation second coming of Christ. Not talking about the rapture, talking about the second coming of Christ now to deal with all of his enemies, put down the opposition, establish his throne on earth, and the beginning of the millennium. When you read on in the book of Revelation, you come to chapter 20, and you find that when Christ comes back, there's going to be a physical resurrection. And the ones that are identified there as coming out of the grave at that point are all of the saints that were slain during the tribulation period. Those people are brought out of the grave. We would say they would be glorified at that point. And they enter into this final stage of God's kingdom on earth, what we call the millennium, this 1,000 years of a golden age when Jesus Christ reigns over Israel on the throne of David and over the whole world, fulfilling these other prophecies in Isaiah and other places I mentioned. For the Apostle Paul to speak of life from the dead and be pointing to that event, that physical resurrection, what he would be saying is that at the very end of history, right before the millennium, when Christ comes back and they see him whom they have pierced, the Jewish people in mass are going to turn to Christ. And that's going to lead to like one of the very last things that's going to happen in world history, which is this resurrection that issues into the millennium. That is certainly what he's talking about when he gets to the end of this chapter, is the return of Christ and the turning of the Jews to faith. And this also would be another example of a wave of grace upon grace. Really, whichever way you're looking at it, whether more Gentiles coming to faith through the Jews turning back to the Lord, or people actually coming out of the grave because the Jews turn back to the Lord, it is just one wave of grace on top of another wave of grace, assuring us that the rejection of Israel is only temporary. God has storehouses of grace. Normally we think about God's wrath sort of being held back and he's going to finally dump it out on the earth. That's going to happen. That's a very sad but true teaching of Scripture. But, folks, grace trumps judgment in the end. God has got storehouse upon storehouse of grace that he is going to flood the world with. That's what this passage is anticipating for us. So Israel's rejection is only temporary because of that plan of God for Israel's salvation. There's one more thought and one more verse. We're not going to say much about it because it's actually transitioning into the next paragraph. But it is what we find in verse 16. If the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. What in the world is that referring to? It's not something you would have expected. It's a new image, actually a set of images, two images. The first one, the dough offered as first fruits, is referring back to the Old Testament system where when a harvest came, as a way of expressing gratitude, like we're going to have Thanksgiving next week, the people brought to the Lord the first fruit of their harvest. And it was indicating gratitude, but the idea is you dedicate this first part to God, acknowledging that all of it came from God, belongs to him, and he turns back and blesses you. It gives the food a kind of a sacred character, really, all of the harvest. If the first part has been dedicated to the Lord, your enjoyment of the rest of it is really an act of worship, and God blesses you in that. It's got a sacred character to it. So he is appealing to that background, but the question is, what do these first fruits represent in this passage? What is the image pointing to? I think the second part helps to answer the question. He says, if the root is holy, so are the branches. So he's moved from talking about first fruit and the whole lump of dough or all the crops, and now the root and the branches. He's going to elaborate on that, starting at verse 17, using an image that was very common in the Old Testament of the nation of Israel as an olive tree, and the individual people being like the branches on the tree, and of course the Gentiles being grafted in as unnatural branches by the grace of God. That's what he is starting to get into, but he's not talking about the branches, he's not talking about the stalk, or what we might on a tree call the trunk, but he's talking about the root. If the root is holy, then so are the branches. Most of your commentators, and I would tend to agree, would hold that the root of this tree in this illustration is actually the patriarchs. In fact, if you look ahead to verse 28, and Paul is talking about the future of Israel, he says, right now, as regards the gospel, they are enemies of God for your sake, but as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. God started with this group of people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were the historical beginning of that tree. They were the root of it in that sense. They were not the root in the sense that they somehow deserved that. They were not the root in that it was their righteousness that got them connected with God. It wasn't even their faith that really was the issue. They were the starting point by virtue of a gracious covenant that God made with them. So that when I speak of the patriarchs, really I'm speaking of the covenant by which God made this relationship and started this process that we would end up calling the nation of Israel. It's really inseparably connected. The point is, God made some unconditional covenants with these people, some unconditional commitments. And God was going to be true to what he said to the patriarchs. And he, in making those promises, made them holy in the sense that he set them apart for special blessing to them and to their physical descendants. If the Lord is going to be consistent with his own character, it means this, that God is going to find a way to overcome the unbelief of Israel so that the whole nation is brought back to himself, despite the fact that he had rejected a lot of them along the way, and they had rejected him too. That's really the bottom line argument as to why Israel's rejection is temporary. It's really the explanation for the point I've already made. I said first that their rejection is temporary because of God's plan for Israel's salvation. The second and fundamental argument is God's faithfulness to Israel's patriarchs. The Lord is not going to go back on what he said to Abraham, that he was going to bless him and his seed, and through his seed, bless all families of the earth. Or as the Apostle Paul will say in verse 29, for the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. He is not going to go back on what he promised. That's really the bottom line of all this. He has a plan, and that assures us that the rejection is temporary. But that plan is the outworking of something very, very ancient that he is not going to change his mind on. The Lord does not break his promises. Now, Paul's going to go on to elaborate on that. He is going to go on to apply some of these things very specifically to us Gentiles. As we close, I want to share with you some more general applications that came to my mind as I looked at this text. And I've got six of them. I'm not going to develop them very much, just to encourage you here. Number one, be encouraged by this. Expect surprises in God's work. What Paul has said here is not something that the Old Testament anticipated or that the Jewish people anticipated. God is going to be faithful. That is what he ended with. But God's faithfulness does not always work out in the way that we anticipate. There are plenty of bends in the road, and there are plenty of twists in the plot, and there are plenty of surprise endings. His ways are not our ways. And if that is the case for this greatest thing, probably it's the case for a lot of other areas of God's work, that he will surprise us. Expect surprises. Number two, believe that God can use even sin to contribute to his work. That's a hard one to accept. The Bible is filled with so many examples. Believe that God can use even sin to contribute to advance his own work. Remember the words there in verses 11 to 12. He spoke of Israel stumbling. Twice he talked about them, their trespass. He spoke about their failure. But that was not the end of the story. That was actually a part of the plot. There's going to be this resolution at the end, and it's all going to come together for the glory of God. But one of the elements in the plot was actually human sin. And the human sin actually was a step that God used to get the program completed. What an encouraging thought. As we struggle against our own sin, as we find ourselves frustrated by other people's sin, God is able to use sin to contribute to his work. Number three, believe as well that God can turn around the most impossible situations. Because when you look at the Jewish people and the very strong statements about their hardness, I mean, we might have just given up at Romans 11:10 and moved on to the next chapter and just forgotten the whole thing, given up on them. How can there be any turnaround? The whole point is there is going to be a turnaround. This passage ought to give us hope about the so-called hard cases that we may be discouraged about. God is able to turn around the most impossible of situations. Number four. Make much of the role that God has given you in his redemptive plan. Remember Paul talked about magnifying his ministry. He was so excited about what God gave him to do. He wasn't minimizing it. And yet I want to add this. Make much of the role that God has given you in his redemptive plan, comma, even if you don't entirely understand it. And I'm getting that from the fact that when Paul talked about magnifying his ministry, he said this, in order somehow to make my fellow Jews jealous. That word somehow is there reflecting the original, introducing a little bit of uncertainty as to exactly how this is going to happen. And he knows the end, but frankly, he's not sure about how many Jews are going to be saved in his lifetime, being made jealous by the Gentiles in his ministry. He didn't know that, you know, here we are 2,000 years and running, and this hasn't all come to pass yet. He's got the big picture. He doesn't know all the steps on the way. He says, Lord, I'm following you, and I'm thrilled about this, so that somehow, some way in your providence, I don't know exactly how, but this is all going to come together to do these things in your plan. And how often we are uncertain about the outcome of our ministries and how we fit in and how much difference we're making. Paul was uncertain as well, but he was pretty excited about the privilege of serving God and having some part in this process. Number 5, put the grace of God on display. I believe the Lord uses, just like he's going to use the Gentiles to reach the Jews, as they are beholding this grace and God's favor, and they're wondering, what happened to me? I want that. That happens in our lives as well. And it involves evangelism, but it involves just yielding to God's grace in your life and allowing him to work and being faithful to him and allowing him to sanctify you, because there are people who, in observing that, may be attracted to the gospel. Somebody wrote this: this must mean that there is some deep intrinsic attractiveness about a people shaped by grace, so that when religious unbelievers, such as the Jews, see real grace transforming a church, some of them say to themselves, I really want what they have got. That would be wonderful. That's what we desire. Yes, for the Jews, but for anybody that observes us, that as they behold the grace of God on display in our lives, it would generate in them the desire, man, there's something supernatural going. I want that. May God enable us to put his grace on display. And finally, let us just marvel at the matchless grace of God. This is leading to that doxology at the end. Somebody wrote, it is a miracle when outsiders receive grace. It is an even more wonderful miracle when hardened religious insiders are opened to that same grace. And this is a great encouragement to us who are growing up perhaps in a home where we are surrounded by God's truth, and from a heritage where these things have always been known. We find ourselves struck with dramatic conversions. Paul is saying, you know what? Maybe the dramatic conversion is not this quote-unquote wicked sinner out there. It's the person who has had these things all of their life and has been relying on them for their salvation. And at some point, they come to realize that they are spiritually bankrupt, and God overcomes their hardness and draws them to faith. That is an even greater example of the grace of God, to save somebody relying upon their religious benefits and surroundings. I trust the Lord will not only give us understanding about the future from this passage, but would encourage us and deepen his work of grace in our hearts.